You are listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Ben Nelson.
And I'm Milena Carrasco. It's Thursday, August 22nd at 5:06 p.m. We're broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. On today's show, you'll hear an interview with a UBC student from Kashmir named Zainab. She discusses an upcoming protest and explains how what is happening in Kashmir is affecting Kashmir Canadians in the Lower Mainland.
We also have a short interview with organizer Susan Russell from last week's the 19th birthday Youth in Care Deserve demonstration in front of City Hall. This creative protest was staged to demand more support for youth in care.
Our final feature is a tour of local artist Sarah Mulkin's 24th art show, Love Madness, happening at the Arts Factory this Friday, August 23rd. Sarah's work explores social media and its effects on our emotions and ability to communicate.
But first, headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. The big Vancouver news of the week. Park Board General Manager Malcolm Bromley ordered that structures and tents be removed from Oppenheimer Park in downtown Vancouver by August 21st at 6 p.m., which was yesterday night. The people who live in Oppenheimer Park were given a two-day notice to pack up all their belongings. According to a City of Vancouver press release issued today, VPD officers were, quote, in the park to keep the peace, end quote, but will not remove people living in the park without further legal authorization and notice, because forced eviction would be a violation of international human rights law. There's been a lot of talk about people's belongings potentially being discarded. According to the city and park board, only unwanted items or items that have clearly been abandoned will be thrown out. However, Caitlin Shane, a lawyer with Pivot, says there is no system in place currently to accurately determine whose belongings have actually been abandoned versus whose are in use. Shane also pointed out that there's no clear system for how people will be able to get their possessions back once they've maybe mistakenly been discarded. Shane met with city workers and other officials yesterday, and they agreed to stop taking down tents. However, city workers still removed multiple tents this morning. As of today, between 75 and 93 of the approximately 200 people living in the park have accepted housing. The numbers vary a bit depending on the source. The City of Vancouver said, quote, good quality housing options remain available. These include nonprofit-run buildings and SROs. They also suggested campers stay in the city shelters. Brenda Proxen, the regional director at BC Housing, stated, we take into account that it's stressful, but we don't force it.
And just something I wanted to point out from the previous story I introduced was that I said Sarah Mulkin's 24th art show. I meant it's a 24-hour art show. It's only on for 24 hours. But yeah, thank you for that headline, Milena. That's obviously a really big story this week, mm-hmm. and it's ongoing. And it's really an extension of a crisis that's been going on for a long time in the downtown east side, where people who are experiencing homelessness don't want to stay in shelters because they can't, you know, bring their pets or be with their partners, and it's often not safe. Their stuff gets stolen, etc. So the city has provided some housing, which my question when I hear that too right away is like, you know, if they found almost 100 places for almost 100 people to stay, it's like, well, why wasn't that available before? You know, it's like, how does this suddenly become available? I find that interesting because this sort of thing happens. It's like when the Balmoral and the Regent were expropriated, I think is the right word, by the city because the conditions they were in were so deplorable and it was a health hazard and a safety hazard. Then it was like the city had all these places for people to live, like all these rooms. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, you had them the whole time? Like, I don't understand how these rooms suddenly become available, but I think that's something that we could look into. Anyway, so an ongoing situation that we will keep watch on, so thanks for sharing that with us.
Of course.
And then we'll go to Ben Nelson at our sports desk, which is not a desk, but just a chair in the same room we're in.
All right, so before I start my sports update, I just want to make a minor correction. Last week, I said it was Coquitlam's first appearance in the Little League World Series when it is, in fact, their second. So they deserve even more credit than they've already been getting. So Canada, unfortunately, has just been eliminated from the Little League World Series. Canada started off the competition with a 5-0 loss to Mexico, but they quickly rebounded and had a stunning performance in their 10-0 trounce over Italy. In their third and final game, they were defeated by the Caribbean region's Curaçao. Curaçao is not to be taken lightly in the baseball world. The small island won the Little League World Series back in 2004. Curaçao has also produced some of the brightest stars in Major League Baseball today, such as LA Dodgers star pitcher Kenley Jansen. Canada has yet to win the Little League World Series. In 1965, the Canadian team from Stoney Creek, Ontario, came in second. This is still the nation's best result at the Little League World Series. BC's best finish representing Canada at the Little League World Series are 2 third-place finishes in 1990 and 1998, respectively. Coquitlam should keep their heads high. They're still the best Little League team in all of Canada this year, and they had a convincing 10-0 shutout on the international stage. The team has captured the hearts of their city, having tons of support online. A congratulations has even come in from their school board. Fans of the team are going to the airport tonight to welcome home the team. Well done, Coquitlam. You'll be back in your third Little League World Series before you even know it.
Good job, Coquitlam. Good job, Coquitlam. My mic is now on again. That's amazing. Thank you for those headlines. So we're going to move on to our first story, which is a short one. Our newest news collective comrade, Enli Su, who wasn't able to be with us in studio, went down to City Hall this past Friday, August 16th. He was there to cover a creative demonstration led by FCCO, which is Fostering Community Change Organizers. And the demonstration they threw was called the 19th Birthday Youth in Care Deserve. It was a public demonstration meant to call on the government's lack of social, physical, and economic support of youths who leave the foster care system once they turn 19, the legal age of adulthood, which is called aging out of foster care. The activists argue leaving the system at such a young age creates tremendous stress for youths who have just who are still too young to be fully autonomous. So the event was, really creative. I wasn't there, but I saw photos. The activists and former and current foster youth wore, like, birthday hats, and they had a birthday cake. And it was very creative. It was very smart. Enli was able to speak with one of the organizers. Her name is Susan Russell, and she's a former youth in care. She's from Winnipeg, and she provides her perspective on the foster care system in Canada and what needs to be changed. So we have this short interview with her here. Let's go to that.
So I'd like to learn what's more about this. What is this happy birthday about? We received some news about it, that you guys are organizing a protest, and then decided to come out here just to see what's all about. And I'm curious to learn more, to hear from your perspective.
Okay, this is our 19th birthday event. It's titled the 19th birthday that youth in care deserve. So typically, when a youth ages out of care at 19, it's a tumultuous time, and more often than not, they miss their 19th birthday celebration due to the anxieties about aging out of care. So at that time, when they age out, they're often they leave the care with minimal support, and necessarily don't have time to put that care towards themselves to celebrate what they've accomplished so far. So we're doing that today. So we're celebrating youth in care. It's a little bit of a belated birthday party for those who turned 19 and didn't have the opportunity to celebrate at that time. So we're having some cake and ice cream today. There'll be some speeches. And then it's just very much a recognition of the youth in care and then our community.
Wow, that's pretty cool. What is your involvement with the community and helping out with youth work?
As a previous youth in care, I grew up in Winnipeg. I moved out here a couple years ago, and now I'm involved with the community with Dylan, where campaign organizers for fostering change.
I see. And how many years have you been working in the system?
In the capacity of an organizer, this is my first official job. Overall, about 5 or 6 years.
5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And what has your experience been in the foster care system? It's something that people don't really know too much about, being in the system and coming out of it, and I'd just love to hear more about your experience and your perspectives.
I came from a very large family, and more than half of my siblings aged out without a home that they were had belonging in. As far as my perspective goes, I think there's a lot of changes that need to be made in the system to support people in care and aging out of care.
Well, what changes do you think that can be addressed by the government?
We're pushing for more supports, specifically AYA supports, to have comprehensive and universal supports. So that'll look like a holistic approach to supporting youth as they age out of care. So more mental health supports, more financial supports, something that mimics a belonging in a family.
I see. Yeah. Thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Hello, and we are back. This is Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard an interview with one of the organizers of last week's The 19th Birthday Youth in Care Deserve, which was a demonstration in front of City Hall. And we're going to take a short break, and then we're going to be back with more local news. So please stay with us. We'll be right back. What's the best way to end off summer?
What's the best way to end summer? Well, traditionally, I would go and play a music festival.
That is so wrong.
Okay, well, the first answer... This is a really hostile interview. This is... Okay, so...
Listen up. There's only one way to end off summer, and that's at the Victory Square Block Party. On September 1st, come bid adieu to the warm weather at the summer's best party. It's fun, it's free, and we want you there. Victory Square Block Party features performances by Kim Mortal, Biawana, Love Goon, Sunrise Social, Sylvia Rath, Lucid, Oblomov, and Tonk. Plus, there'll be tasty food vendors and a raffle with kick butt prizes. That's September 1st from 2 to 9 p.m. See you there.
Punk Rock's premier sisters, Skating Polly, are returning to Vancouver, earning praise from members of X, The Flaming Lips, Babes in Toyland, and more. The grungy three-piece plays September 4th at Lana Luz, joined by local phenomenon Joe Past. Tickets available at rickshawtheater.com and both Red Cat Records locations. See you there.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We just heard some local headlines and a short story on youth in foster care demonstration from last week. So we're going to turn now to an issue of international interest. Last Thursday, August 15th, Vancouverites might have encountered a group of Kashmiri students and activists leading a solidarity march at the Indian Consulate in downtown Vancouver. These protesters were marching in solidarity with the Kashmiri people who have been in a lockdown after the Indian government revoked several articles of the Indian Constitution concerning Kashmir. To find out more about the recent protests and what is happening in Kashmir and how it is affecting people in the Lower Mainland, News Collective comrade Arman Reyna spoke with Zainab, a Vancouver Kashmiri student activist involved with the protests.
Zainab Rauf, one of the Kashmiri students who led a protest in Vancouver on the 15th of August. To start, could you tell us a bit about yourself?
I am a UBC student. I am majoring in economics and trying to minor in statistics. The protest was a solidarity march that we held in Vancouver for the removal of Article 370 in Kashmir. And this protest didn't only go in Vancouver, but it was organized globally. It was organized in Toronto, Seattle, Detroit, Sydney, London. It was all over, everywhere, wherever the Kashmiri community was gathered. That's where we all tried to get together, get ourselves on WhatsApp groups and Facebook groups and organize these protests, because everything in Kashmir was put under a lockdown. So we knew people in Kashmir couldn't protest for their rights. So we thought it's high time that we come out of our houses here in global communities and show the government that we do not agree with what they have done and it's not right.
You mentioned an article just now. There was two articles, Article 35A and Article 370. Could you give our listeners some background about why the Indian government is removing these articles and what the implications of removing these articles are?
Well, Article 370 basically is an article that was constructed to protect the clauses in Instrument of Accession. And what those clauses were that India has legal rights over foreign affairs, defense, and communication in Kashmir, but everything else, Kashmir gets to have its own. For example, its own flag, its own government, its own constitution, its own laws. And what 35A is, an article that says that you can't, any non-permanent resident of Jammu of Kashmir cannot buy land in Jammu and Kashmir. Only Kashmiris and Kashmiris can buy land in Jammu and Kashmir. And by removing these two articles, the government has gone against its constitution and now fully implemented the fact that Jammu and Kashmir will be directly ruled by the central government from New Delhi. And they've done this without the Jammu and Kashmir government being there in the parliament or agreeing to it, as they're under house arrest. And removing these two articles now allows people to buy land, to invest in Jammu and Kashmir, and to the government to have more national projects in Jammu and Kashmir. And basically, it's now a full-blown type of a settler colonization, if you can say it, because without the Article 370, the Instrument of Accession doesn't legally take place anymore, and that was the only legal document that Kashmir signed with India while acceding to it. And now without it, it no longer holds any legal rights in Kashmir. So this is, you can say, a complete occupation and start of a settler colonization.
So would you say that the Article 370 gave Kashmir a certain amount of autonomy?
Yes, definitely. It gave Kashmir an autonomy, and that's not something that's like, oh, they were special or they've been giving special rights. It was our right, because we had yet not had our plebiscite. We had yet not had a referendum. So it's just, we were a princely state before partition, and we were an individual state after. We were not, like, legally or bindingly a part of any of these countries, China, Pakistan, or India. So we did have the autonomy that we fully deserved and had the right to, and that autonomy had to be temporary because we yet had to, these countries yet had to move back to give us our right for plebiscite. So, yeah.
So what, in your view, was the purpose of this protest?
Well, it was trying to say that we fully respect and we fully know that the fundamentals that India stands as a country, and we actually support that, which is of democracy. And they completely ruined that spirit, that fabric they hold for their nation by putting our government on house arrest, our leaders on house arrest, our lawyers on house arrest, our people under curfew. If there was any law that you had to pass on your integral state, how can you do that by putting everybody in a house arrest? And, like, how is that even democratic in the first place? So our protest was one for this. And our second was that it's high time that we're going to fight again for our right to self-determination, like our right for taking our referendum in our hands, our right to decide what we want to do with our own land and our future.
The events in Kashmir have had a personal impact on you and your family. Could you talk a bit about how you were affected by this?
I was really much affected by this because I didn't get to talk to my mom until yesterday, like 13, 14 days. And it made me feel like I was I was in like 1947 during partition. I could not believe that this was 2019, and this is not something that's happening in a non-democratic country or with authoritative government. This is happening in a fully democratic, proud, secular country, and people are keeping silent about this, whereas I am here sitting and not being able to hear my mother's voice for 13 days. So it really mentally impacted me, even though this is not the first time it's happened in Kashmir. It's happened many times, but those have only been for like 2 to 3 days, so we've let it go. And mostly this used to happen more frequently when social media was not there. But today there's social media. Today there we have platforms to raise our voices. So for these 13 days, for this to happen, I really couldn't contain myself, and I went crazy asking people how the world is quiet about this. So that's how it impacted me. And also, as a Kashmiri of like the fourth generation after in being occupied by three countries, it just made me realize that my purpose is bigger than just maybe going and working for a company when I grow up. I have bigger things to aim for. I have people back home who don't have the privilege to study and educate themselves the way I do. So these 13 days actually reminded me that I have so much to work hard for, so much to be thankful of, and so much to not take granted of.
You spoke a bit about social media. A lot of Indian media can give a very particular perspective on the situation in Kashmir. In your experience, what are some good media sources that Canadians could use to find out more about what is happening there?
Oh, I can tell you another fun fact. India's media actually ranks 143rd in world media freedom ranking, and that's below Palestine and Jordan. And those are not democratic countries, and those are not superpowers. But I would really support and encourage people to check out local Kashmiri journalists and their media platforms, which few of them are like Rising Kashmir, the Greater Kashmir, and for a more unbiased opinion, you could also maybe check out Reuters.
You wrote letters to some of the MPs?
Oh, yeah. We actually formed groups and we wrote many letters to them. And even during our solidarity protests, we gathered like 600 letters that were signed to Justin Trudeau and a few of the MPs. I think two of them actually replied, putting out a statement.
What are some ways that people or politicians in Vancouver can show solidarity for this?
I'm really not asking politicians or any human being to choose sides between India, Pakistan, or China, or to say who's wrong, who's right, but I am definitely asking for politicians who represent so many of the voices to stand for human rights, basic liberties of a human being, and as Canadian MPs or leaders, your basic thing is of democracy, to stand up for it. And when you see your fellow country that you're holding trade and diplomatic relations with, I feel like it's your duty to stand up and go like, you're not following the human rights protocol, you're not following the democratic spirit that you're supposed to. And I feel like that's the thing that Canadian leaders should keep in mind when they release a statement, which they should.
There was a term that came up often, I heard in the reporting about the protests, they talk about Azadi. What does Azad mean for our listeners?
Oh, well, first of all, Azad Kashmir is the Pakistan-occupied Kashmir, and Jammu and Kashmir is the Indian-occupied Kashmir. And then there's the Chinese-occupied Kashmir. We're divided into three. And what Azadi means, I think it's an Urdu-Hindi term saying freedom. So when we chant for Azadi, we're chanting for freedom, our freedom. So that's what it means, the literal term. But for many of us, Azadi also means the freedom of speech, freedom of self-determination, freedom of taking into your hands your own future, and freedom of electing your own government, freedom of your government making laws for you that you believe in, and not just some other government coming and throwing things on you. So I feel like that's what Azadi means for us.
Okay, so you're saying there was a protest going to take place, another one, in a couple of days. Can you just tell our audience about it in case they're interested in participating or just taking part in it?
So there is a protest on 25th August, which is this Sunday, from 3 to 5. Yeah, so it's in Surrey Holland Park, and it'll be great if everybody could march together with us for democracy, human rights, basic civil liberties of the Kashmiri people and of the whole globe.
Awesome, thank you. Today I'm joined.
All right. Thanks to our comrade, our man Reyna, for that story. We're going to take a short break, but stay tuned because up next we have a story on Vancouver's most exciting new art show, Love Madness, happening for just 24 hours starting tomorrow. Stay tuned.
But twice, you burn the stakes again, and those were expensive stakes.
Unibrow Arts Festival is back to shake things up in venues up and down Main Street, August 22nd to the 25th. Featuring 10 live comedy shows, an outdoor zine market, art shows, screenings, artist talks, a flash tattoo day, comedy DJs, and live musical performances. Check them out, won't you, at unibrowartsfest.com for more details.
Seriously, Francis, this was a T-bone steak we're talking about. It cost me almost $30. And you burned.
Good people of CITR land of Vancouver, of the lower mainland, not really. My name is Chris Sarifik.
August 23rd at the Toast Collective. That's Friday.
Or, as I like to call it, the day that I find out how unbelievably unpopular my show is.
We've only just begun.
Come celebrate 20 years of the Parts Unknown show with Chris Horrific and special guests Garbage Dreams, Jerk Jails, and from Missoula, Montana, Wrinkles. It is also the release of Chris Horrific's new album, Treats. That's Friday, August 23rd at the Toast Collective.
This summer, take a walking tour of the outdoor art on the UBC campus. Since the late 1940s, works of outdoor art have been collected by the university to enrich the campus environment. Together, these artworks give voice to multiple stories about the history of UBC and Vancouver, and are part of an ever-evolving narrative about art, space, and place, and our own sense of ourselves. There's guided tours featuring highlights of the collection. They vary in length from 1 to 1.5 hours. You can also enjoy a self-guided tour at your own pace. Download the Outdoor Art Tour Book or pick up a copy at the gallery. Suggested routes take about 20 minutes to walk, while a full tour takes about 3 hours. To find out more, or to book a tour, go to belkin.ubc.ca and search for Outdoor Art Tours.
And we're back! You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. All right, so our next and final feature story is on an exciting new art show. This Friday, tomorrow, local artist Sara Malkin presents a new series of 16 paintings at Vancouver Arts Factory. These paintings look at the way our careful curation of self on social media impacts our relationships. Like your favorite Instagram stories, this show will be up for only one night before disappearing. This story is brought to us by comrade Annie Router. Let's take a listen.
Industrial Avenue off Main Street. Going to meet local artist Sara Malkin at the Arts Factory, which is where her studio is. You can see that there's Vancouver Mural Festival murals outside the building. It's big, long, blue. So let's go on in.
Last week, I met Sara to talk about her upcoming art show this Friday, August 23rd. It's called Love/Madness, and it's all about social media, how we curate ourselves online, why we want attention, and some of the universal things we do with our phones, but don't always admit.
Whether it's like sharing screenshots of conversations with your friends or...
We've all done it.
If you think you haven't done it, you absolutely are lying right now to yourself mostly. But even just sharing content that's not necessarily your own.
And like an Instagram story vanishes in 24 hours, so will Sara's show. So let me take you into her studio to learn more about the one-day painting show and her relationship with social.
My name is Sarah Mulchin. I am a visual artist in Vancouver, Canada, and I am a large-scale conceptual figurative painter.
And so can you tell me what we're looking at right now? Like, what's the space like?
The space is about 100 square feet, and we're surrounded by several paintings. Some of them are the large-scale portraits that will be in the show on August 23rd. Colorful, photorealistic, playful, and all self-portraits.
Just as I'm looking around, I'm seeing what looks like to me like a very unified kind of color palette. So how would you describe your style and how they all connect together?
So definitely contemporary portraiture, but also I rely a lot on the use of pink. Pink is an escapism color, so it alludes to the idea and the hope of love and romance, but also fantasy and an escape from reality. So when I'm thinking about creating like a digital identity that's not actually in the digital sphere, pink makes sense because it represents an escape. So, and then pink is also feminine, but an excess of pink can also mean being like emotionally claustrophobic.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Psychology of color for you. So for me, pink is, there's just so much with pink. Pink is also traditionally a masculine color. There's just so much to pull from with the color pink, and it's also completely synthetic, kind of like social.
Another unnatural part of social is how it can take us out of the present. Sarah wants people at the show to fully immerse themselves in her work, and she added an augmented reality component to six of the paintings, which you can only see in person.
One thing that I can only talk about so much through the paintings is there's an image and you're kind of filling in your own blanks. And I loved the idea of kind of planting Easter eggs within the paintings that allow you to have an additional experience. So without being at the show on the 23rd, you will miss out on that experience because it can't be replicated without being within the space. So I thought one of the things that I always kind of like is through internet culture is the discovery of Easter eggs, where there's a connection between several films or several books. And people are like, oh, well, they planted this thread and then there's one here. And not a conspiracy theory, because it's literally proved as something that exists. Disney is a really great example of that, where they will plant characters from other films in new films and old films, and you'll see these like reoccurring kind of, it's for the fans, it's for the people who understand. And I kind of want to give everybody this like insider status. So where they get to learn something new about the piece that they wouldn't have gotten to know if they only viewed it through a screen. So they have to be here in person and see it.
Sarah's work also plays with self-image, how we curate ourselves on different social media platforms like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and even LinkedIn.
I have always been interested in social media and the way that we curate our own online image. With the advent of the internet, especially as a millennial, we often brand ourselves a certain way. So for me, I find it interesting to see how I brand myself and how I choose to curate myself. And as an artist, it's always interesting to take things out of context. So for me, bringing a digital experience into an analog format and then incorporating additional digital elements back into it is an interesting conversation to start.
And I saw on your Facebook page, your motto is social media, but make it art. Can you tell me a bit about that and why social media is the particular thing that you focus on in a lot of your art?
So part of that is a pop culture reference. It's an overused trope for joke formats, either on Twitter or through memes. And it's the idea of take something but make it something. So One of the things, it kind of spanned from America's Next Top Model, so reality TV, where she says, do this, but make it fashion. So
yeah.
I immediately was like, do this, but make it art. And I've been kind of thinking about that for a while. There's this whole debate around the self-portrait, specifically the selfie, and whether or not it's a valid art form. So I'm like, well, what if I take it and elevate it by painting it the way that we used to paint it? Because there's this argument that people are like, oh, well, people just take selfies now. And then they forget that before there were selfies, we would literally labor over a painting for hours and upon hours to get a portrait of yourself. So it's instantaneous now. And then I've also taken it and made it a labor-intensive, time-consuming project.
Can you tell me a bit? Instagram, the photo-sharing platform with over 1 billion users, is filled with selfies. There are more than 400 million posts that use the hashtag selfie. Sarah finds it hard to believe the platform launched less than a decade ago, in October 2010. It was around the same time that Sarah graduated from her first fine art degree.
I graduated from my first degree in 2011. Social was, it wasn't all-consuming the way it is now. And Instagram was also, like, just coming up. Like, it was a very new child. I think there's often this, it feels like it's been around forever at this point, but it really hasn't. And then as I went back to school, because I decided to pursue a more theoretical practice instead of a technical one, I realized that social media was not only a great resource in terms of getting, well, unsolicited critiques, but also solicited ones. You could also create a really interesting community. So there are so many wonderful aspects of social, but there are also some really negative ones. So after I graduated in 2015 from Emily Carr, which was my second BFA, I had my 15 minutes. So I went viral. So I had a really interesting experience with social. I went viral for paint mixing. It was like, it's almost embarrassing, but I was so disappointed in the work I was creating at the time. I was only showing behind the scenes aspects of my practice. So one of the things that I was showing a lot was mixing paint, and I kind of fell into this trend that had happened without knowing that it was already a thing. And it just blew up, and I said yes to everything because why not? But with that came that sort of surge in visibility, also came a surge in like the really dark side of social media. So bullying, trolls, things that existed kind of on the peripherals of my online experience. So when I decided to reevaluate my practice after that, social media has just become so ingrained in who I am as an artist. It almost seemed ridiculous to ignore it. So.
Can you tell me a bit more about going viral? Like, where did this video travel and what kind of things, I guess, both good and not so kind, if you're comfortable talking about it, were people saying about a paint mixing video?
So the first video I made was November of 2015. It was a stop motion of mixing an entire palette, and nothing really came of that. And then in January, I had created a close-up clip because someone had requested it. And I was like, oh, look, someone actually wants to see something I'm doing. And as an artist, like, you want to be seen. You want to exist. So I started sharing that content. That content doesn't exist on my profiles anymore. I redacted it completely when it was time for me to move on. But that content traveled all the way across the world. So I had media coverage from several like U.S. publications. A talk show in the Netherlands talked about me on like a late night TV talk show. There was an article posted in German with Broadly by Vice, and it just kind of like flew across the world. And I, part of me is like, it was my 15 minutes, but it was like a year of nonstop, like things popping up about me. And all the media coverage was really positive. It was the backlash from the audience that was really hard to deal with. So there were a lot of like really low key, like aggressive comments, I guess, like claiming I was wasting paint, that I wasn't actually a painter, that which to me was ridiculous because I was also posting my paintings at this point. And then as much as those were like kind of like, okay, people don't like my content, that's fine, there were people who would come out of nowhere and make comments about like my hands and be like, oh, your hands are disgusting. I'm like, okay, because you can see my hand in the video. Or they could hear me breathing through my respirator and make some like comment about me having asthma and how I was probably going to die because that's what it sounded like. And then I had people with using the acronym like go kill yourself. And that one was probably the hardest because lots of people, especially in like BC, we deal with seasonal depression. So to have people like constantly telling you that like what you're making is invaluable and that you should go die was really hard. And it was, I think the most striking thing for me though, is that most of these comments were coming from quote unquote children. So we're talking like early teens, and that's really scary when I think about my own experience growing up. Like I didn't have to deal with that. The worst thing that happened is like I posted a poem that somebody wrote on a website that I made in high school, and then that person was sad and then I took it down. So but there was never any like malicious intent behind anything. When I was like, bullying happened to your face when I was in high school. Didn't happen behind closed doors on the internet or through Instagram or just through text even. Like, that wasn't a thing.
Mm-hmm. So having had that experience with social, you've still chosen to make it a huge part of your work. So as you think about social so often, what would you change about social media now? And is that, does that play into your art at all in terms of like commenting on what you think should change?
I am still always trying to figure out social. So despite the fact that I kind of, my day job is in marketing and communications and content creation, I still am constantly trying to figure it out. So social to me is ever evolving, and there's always something new. And what's interesting is having seen platforms come and go, I'm actually mildly surprised by how long the current platforms have actually lasted. It would be nice if there was a level of like ambiguity around your identity on social again. I think that being able to have some form of privacy online would be really interesting. But as we've seen through some of those platforms like 4chan or 8chan, having that level of ambiguity is not necessarily creating a positive place.
I think. But Sarah doesn't comment on what she thinks should change about social through her art. Instead, she paints part of her life she normally wouldn't put on social.
I don't really address any of that in my work because I'm really taking the most personal aspects of my life and making them as public as possible. but most of the stuff that I paint about isn't on social. So it's my life through the lens of social.
So it's not, you're not necessarily replicating what you're putting on social. It's kind of the pieces of you that you keep away from social, more so to yourself and like the people who are close to you.
A little bit, yeah. Some of the paintings are definitely, they speak to very personal experiences in my life. And the way that they're portrayed is as if they were posted on social.
At the same time, the messages in Sarah's work are also universal. The last piece she showed me in her studio speaks to that.
one other piece that's finished here. Also pink. Surprise! This one is a straight-on portrait. And then there's a caption at the bottom that reads, "Reading through your messages is my favorite way to die," which is actually a song lyric from a Kay Flay song, but also real feels. The amount of times people like read through messages with somebody like after a fight or after like a relationship goes sour or whatever the case may be, that you need to dwell on the things that were said between you and that person. Because that's really that what that's about. And the image was actually a total accident. So when I was taking images for another painting, this one was taken as like, I was like getting the camera ready and I wasn't ready and it took the photo. And then I was like, oh, that will make a good painting. So some things are really like natural and easy. And others take like a full blown like mini set photo shoot, very like influencer style, where you have somebody like fluffing. But I do everything myself. They are actually selfies. So whether it's self timer or like selfie stick, it's all selfies. And most of them are taken on my phone.
Sarah has less than a day to show these pieces that transform a cell phone selfie into fine art.
One day made sense in the way that it's referencing the story, the disappearing story, the like throwaway into the void, but it's also logical in terms of being an independent artist.
Conceptually, Sarah's show is like a social media story. It only lasts for one day. Then the paintings come off the walls and get stored. It's ephemeral. But a one-day show is also practical. It means Sarah can avoid extra staffing, longer event licenses, and taking time off of her day job.
Instead, I was like, I'll throw everything I have into this night, and I'll just like get a liquor license for a way longer time, and like, let's make it a party. Let's make it a place to be and like have fun and drink and like experience something that can only be experienced in person. So I have my hands in like every aspect of this show. So the title wall will also be a selfie wall, because you cannot have a show about selfies at the close of Leo season and think that you can get away without a selfie wall. So so I've got that. I've got my bartenders have everything set with colors that coordinate with my work. I have a playlist that has sound bites in between songs that I have like created myself that you wouldn't be able to listen to on Spotify outside of the show because they're local files. So they're not available for a public download. Just every little aspect, whether it's the vinyl and the curation to the experience that I'm hoping to create, I've got my fingers in all of it.
What do you hope people will take away from the show at the end of the day?
I guess my goal always is having an experience with my work that feels relatable. So not necessarily like somewhat universal, but also being able to look at it and be like, man, I know what that feels like. And that level of almost empathy, but also feeling like it could be you, or man, I did that, or I really feel that, or like that's a mood, anything like that, where people feel some sort of connection to the work based on their own experience. So bringing their own life choices into the show and then seeing that, oh, I'm not actually alone in any of these choices. This seems actually like it happens to everybody.
Was there anything else that you wanted to add about the show specifically that we didn't talk about, or not even show specific? But...
I think that we've covered pretty much everything. I mean, ultimately, there is just an experience to be had that night. And I will share the show online, but the experience won't be the same, because you can't create an online gallery that will react the same way to seeing not only like the buzz from the crowd and the music and the effects that are in the paintings and all of that. It's just when you're surrounded by people, it's kind of like the concert idea. You're all experiencing something together, and that experience can't be replicated online.
Love/Madness takes place this Friday night, August 23rd, at the Arts Factory at Main Street and Industrial Avenue. The show is free, and for more information, you can check out the Facebook event, Love/Madness Art Show and Party.
Thanks for listening, and thanks again to the News Collective's Annie Router for her great reporting and production on that piece. If you want to check out Sara's show, it starts tomorrow, Friday, 6 p.m. at the Arts Factory, which is located at 281 Industrial Avenue.
Right. And if you're looking for something else to do this weekend, you can consider checking out our fellow programmer Chris Arific's album release / anniversary show. So Chris is a programmer here and has been doing his show called The Parts Unknown Show. On CITR 101.9 FM for 20 years, which is pretty impressive. So his show's also this Friday at the Toast Collective, but you could check out both shows. You could go to Chris's and then you could go to Sarah's because hers is real late. So consider it.
Mm-hmm. And please join us again next week for another episode of Democracy Watch on Thursday from 5 to 6. Have a great weekend.
Have a great weekend. Thanks for tuning in.